Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
This is Free Range with Von Miller, the podcast where I step outside the lines and I take you with me. Each week, we're talking everything from the biggest stories around the league to the biggest stories off the field. This isn't your average sports podcast. This is game meets culture, locker room meets living room, and no topic is off limits. So if you're into good conversations that ruffle a few feathers, join me every Wednesday and follow Free Range with Von Miller everywhere you get your podcast.
Good evening and welcome to Amplify, a telephone talk show that looks at life from a religious perspective. I'm Father Ron Lingwin, hoping you have felt the warmth of God's love in your life this day, but especially the joy you feel when you share God's love with others. And I hope that the Thanksgiving spirit continues in your heart and in your life today, even as many of us begin our preparations for the celebration of Christ's birth at Christmas. But as we do each week, I'd like to begin a program with this story that is based on faith and formed with imagination. The disciples sat huddled around a softly glowing fire as Jesus stirred the ashes. "This is a good time to ask the Master questions," Peter said to a stranger who had just joined them that day. "Master," the young man addressed Jesus, "you said my song was pleasing to your ears. When I played my flute, I could tell you were beginning to feel each note as if it were a prayer." Jesus nodded in agreement and replied, "The gift of music is a gift which should never be denied to the heart or to the soul." The men didn't understand. And so Jesus went on to explain it was a gift to sit and listen to what man had created from what had been given to them by God as a gift. He said to the young man, "When you hear the roar of the sea, what do you think?" The young man just sat there and thought about the question. Jesus continued, "When you hear raindrops fall to the earth, the cry or laughter of a child, or a storm, these are gifts to you. Sound is a gift to the ear." Then Jesus extended his arm and said, "I remember how a young man came when my father lay dying and sang a song to him. Even though my father could not hear him, the young man gave back to him a gift my father had taught him. My mother cried, but it could be that she was pleased because the song gave comfort to her. Music comforts the sick and the dying. It expresses joy at the birth of a child or at a wedding feast." Peter asked, "Master, what about those who cannot hear?" Jesus answered, "We hear in a different way. They hear in a different way than we, Peter." Then Jesus looked down at the still burning fire and said, "Music is like a flame. It warms and gives comfort to all." Turning to the young man, he said, "Never forget who has given you this gift, and sing your praise to the Father." Then once again he looked down into the flames, and tears began to form in his eyes as he said, "When you go to the temple, go with a song in your heart. And not only will it be pleasing to the Creator, it will also be pleasing to all around you." A story of faith and imagination. Our guest this evening writes in the introduction to his latest book titled Stories Behind the Songs and Hymns About Heaven. One of the most fascinating things I found when researching the stories behind songs about heaven is that most were inspired during difficult and trying times. These beloved hymns were often the product of suffering and penned by people looking for answers. Whether a slave, a person trapped in poverty, a preacher, or a teacher, the writer almost always acknowledged that life on earth was not fair. Hence the need to look forward to a time and a place where love, compassion, and justice were found in abundance. As I studied in detail the lyrics of these classic songs and hymns, I also realized something profound and inspiring. While they point toward an eternal life in heaven, almost all of them spell out ways to bring a bit of heaven to earth. In other words, they are less about the ultimate rewards of a Christian life well lived, and more about how to live a Christian life in this world. In that way, these songs mirror parables of Jesus and his charge found in Matthew to reach out to the least of these. Life is a challenge. Life is a trial. And life is not fair. But for the Christian, there is another life where the books are balanced and love abounds. These are the musical stories of heaven as seen through the eyes of people who live their faith on earth. These chapters offer a roadmap to making the journey to glory a bit easier and more fulfilling. They are also testimonies to the fact that there is a wonderful victory waiting just over the hilltop. And I would second those words. They're written by Ace Collins, who is our guest tonight. He is the Christie Award-winning heir, author of more than 80 books that have sold more than 2.5 million copies. He has written novels, biographies, and children's books, as well as books on history, culture, and faith, and has been the featured speaker at the National Archives Distinguished Lecture Series. The author of Stories Behind the Best Love Songs of Christmas and Stories Behind the Great Traditions of Christmas, and I could add a number of other titles of books we've talked about with Ace over the years. He has appeared on every network's morning TV show and even hosted a television special. He lives in Arkansas with his wife, Kathy. And Ace, I'd like to read before we say hello formally. I'd like to read from a letter you sent out to some people, including me, with advanced copies of the book. I'm going to go to the middle of the letter when you say, "I wish I had written this book before my father died of cancer. I believe it would have helped to have known these stories and had these melodies playing in my head as I sat by his bedside. I find it also interesting that as I wrote these chapters, memories of my mother battling Alzheimer's came rushing back to me. Even when she had forgotten who I was, she still knew the words and sang many of the songs covered in these pages. That, my friend, shows the power of these compositions." Let me stop a second. Michael, somehow he's dropped off the line, if you can get him back on. Don't know what happened there. But he continues, "I would like to conclude by sharing this tidbit from the project. The first song covered in the book is Wayfaring Stranger, and the final song is Victory in Jesus. That's intentional. I believe these are the perfect bookends for the stories in this book. These two songs, written from vastly different points of view, deal with the struggles and the unfair nature of life, coupled to grace and promise found in salvation. While the focus is on heaven, this pair of classics also presents the formula for each of us to bring a bit of heaven down to earth." Ace Collins, welcome to Amplify.
Hello.
Hi. This is hey. Father Ron. How are you doing? Welcome to Amplify.
I'm fine. A little technical glitch there. I got to hear the introduction, and then I just kind of went it somewhere off into mute land, and so I missed everything after that. What a joy to be back with you. Whenever I hear the Amplify theme song, I get excited.
Yes.
And also remember all of the great times that we've had together talking about various things over the years. And you have become a tradition in December for me, and it's a tradition that I highly treasure, getting the opportunity to talk to you and your listeners on Amplify every December. It is a joy to be with you.
Thank you. It's a joy to be with you. What I did is after I read a little bit from the introduction of your book, mm-hmm. I then read a little bit from the letter you sent to some of us with an advance copy where you say, I wish I had written this book before my father died of cancer. And you go on to say...
Yeah, and it would have helped a great deal in those last few weeks to have been reminded about, you know, the ultimate destination for all of us who believe. This was an interesting book, and I'll tell you where it came from. I had not done a story behind book in probably 8 or 9 years, and I moved on to a lot of novels and other things. And my agent, Greg Johnson, had returned from his mother-in-law's funeral and actually called me and said, have you ever considered doing the stories behind songs about heaven? Mm-hmm. And I told him I'd love to. And so we worked out an agreement with Baker Books, who finally purchased it. And I had the opportunity to write a lot of stories behind these songs, do a lot of research. And then they got back with me and told me I'd written too many chapters.
Yeah.
And I said, well, I couldn't just cut them. And they said, well, we only need 30. And I said, I'll tell you what, y'all figure out which 30 you want. But my only requirement is that it has to begin with Wayfaring Stranger and end with Victory in Jesus. I said, I want those as the bookends. And in your introduction, I got to hear a little bit of you mentioned Matthew 25:35
yes.
through 40, reaching out to the least of these. And I think Wayfaring Stranger is the testament of what happens when we don't reach out to the least of these. We get so busy in our world, we tend to look in the mirror more than out the window. And Wayfaring Stranger is the story, an American song, folk song, if you will, inspired possibly by a Native American, possibly by an ex-slave, people who were journeying. They were pilgrims, if you will, with no home to go to. They were impoverished, probably hungry. They were suffering. And there was no one who stopped and helped them. And in that respect, they were the refugees, I guess, of their time. But they also maintained their faith, the songwriter did, and the people that were with him or her, because they knew that there was coming a time when Jesus would treat them equally with everyone else, when they wouldn't be the piece of refuse people wanted to throw away, but a treasured one of God's children to embrace. And I thought that was a beautiful place to begin this book, reminding us that to bring a little bit of heaven to earth by getting involved in the lives of people others forget.
And you mentioned, you write that when Jesus exposed the nature of prejudice in the parable of the Good Samaritan, he likely revealed a picture of God that many in his audience had never known, and that to have Jesus hold up the Samaritan as reflecting God's love, compassion, and grace must have been very sobering to many in that time, and likely still is to this very day.
Yeah, I think we tend to recreate God in our image rather than realizing we're created in his image. And if all of us are children, then God is not black or white or yellow or red. You know, God's image is one of love and acceptance. And I think that's what the Wayfaring Stranger was looking for, that love and acceptance. And thankfully, because he already knew God and had God in his heart, he recognized that that love and acceptance was coming. But God put us here in his image on earth to also preview that love and acceptance right here to other people, the least of these. And if we don't do that, then those people may never meet God. They may not be as fortunate as the Wayfaring Stranger. They may not ever get to know the grace that God has extended to us unless we share that grace. Yeah. And I think that's the strong message in that song. It's a challenge, if you will, for us to bring a little heaven to earth through the way we view people and the way that we treat people.
Yeah, you're right, that it's a song that reveals a faith deeper than most could imagine and a challenge few were willing to accept. And strangely enough, there's no record of who wrote it, But you write that it was likely someone who was poor, misunderstood, and homeless, and it seems they were wandering because they were either lonely or lost.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that, and in one fashion or another, we all should be able to relate to that, because all of us at some point in our lives have been lonely. All of us at some point in our life, even if we haven't been literally lost on the highway or thrown away and lost, we have felt lost. We have wondered where that, you know, we have wondered where that next stop is going to be, or we wondered where that next friend is going to be to reach out and lift us up when we're down. So it was a beautiful place to start the book, because I thought it set in motion these stories about heaven and how, you know, you could take your life and share the elements of your life with others and expose them, particularly if you're talking about faith, with people who might never see it. I think it's, you know, let's put it in a different mode. These songs bring hope, they bring faith, but they also bring illumination. And I think that what you do every year with your creche there in Pittsburgh that I follow so closely on Facebook, and it just overwhelms me when I see the effort that goes into it and the images that come out of it, that creche reminds us of what happened on that first Christmas, but it also reminds us of grace and light and hope, which came into a dark world on that first Christmas. And it is our responsibility, those who have been graced, those who have been saved, if you will, using a much more modern term, I guess, it is our responsibility to share that with others. And that's what the first missionaries did. It's what St. Nicholas did. You know, it's what the man we know as King Wenceslas did now as we're in the Christmas season. It's what the great missionaries that crossed Europe in the 600s, 700s, 800s, and 900s did. And it's what we each should be doing to this day, is exposing a bit of Christ to others.
And one of the connections...
Through our actions.
Yes. Yes. One of the connections that it makes to Christians like myself and many others who are... beginning the season of Advent in preparation for Christmas, is that the writer expects nothing but pain on earth, and yet there is a sense of hope found at the end of each verse. The suffering, you write, will not last. There is a place of acceptance and healing, and it's a message that still endures, and that might be because over 50 years it has appeared on country rock popular and religious charts and has been translated into more than 50 languages. That says a whole lot for this particular hymn.
And is there anything, you and I have talked in person as friends about our families, and is there anything more comforting than knowing that on the other side of this life, your mother is waiting for you? I'm going there to meet my mother, to see my mother again. And I think there's a tremendous amount of comfort if you have the faith to believe that is going to happen. And this wayfaring stranger, in the midst of their suffering, still had the faith to realize on the other side, not only were they going to get to see Jesus, but they were going to get to see all of the people who loved them, who cared for them here. And I think that's a, you know, if you read the first chapter in this book, I think you leave with that hope. And I think that's particularly important. I wrote this book as much as anything else with thoughts of people who were sitting by the bedsides of loved ones who were dying.
Mm-hmm.
And hoping that as they read these chapters, that it would remove a bit of the sadness and bring in a bit of the light that should be a part of all of our experiences because of Christ. You know, that light that came into the darkness. And I think each one of these chapters and each one of these songs exposes a bit of life. And there's so many human lessons in here. The second, you know, the first song that we really spotlight after Wayfaring Stranger is Amazing Grace. And if you look at Amazing Grace, it is a song of redemption.
Ace, let me break in because we only have a minute. before we get started. Yeah. Let's start with that after the break. And let me just read us out to our first break. When we come back, let's talk about Amazing Grace.
That's great.
You write, the prayer is that we each have the faith to endure the journey while maintaining our focus on God. The challenge is to love today's wanderers just as Christ did during his walk on earth. Grace brings us to heaven, and grace shared can bring heaven to the wayfaring stranger. And you write that the only way they will ever meet God is to experience the grace of one who has already been blessed. So we're going to take this break. We come back and we'll speak with Ace Collins about his latest book, Stories Behind the Songs of Hymns and About Heaven. Welcome back to Amplify, where our guest this evening is Ace Collins, talking about his latest book, Stories Behind the Songs and Hymns About Heaven. We talked about the first one, Wayfaring Stranger. Before we move on, perhaps it'd be good just to read the lyrics. I am a poor wayfaring stranger, traveling through this world of woe. There is no sickness, toil, or danger in that fair land to which I go. I'm going home to see my mother. I'm going home no more to roam. I'm just a-going over Jordan. I'm just a-going over home. I know the dark clouds will hover over me. I know my pathway is rough and steep. But golden fields lie out before me, where eerie eyes no more shall weep. For I'm going home to see my father. I'm going home no more to roam. I'm just a-going over Jordan. I'm just a-going over home. I'll soon be free from every trial. This form shall rest beneath the sun. I'll drop the cross of self-denial and enter in that home with God. So beautiful, isn't it, Ace? So powerful.
It is a beautiful song, and it's a beautiful thought. The old melody is absolutely gorgeous as well. There's a modern song stylist named Mandy Barnett that sings that song. You can find it on her version on YouTube, and I think it carries the emotion. She fully understands and carries the emotion of that writer's words probably better than anybody I've ever heard. It's just, you know, it sends chills down your back.
Well, you'll bet. The next
mentioned Amazing Grace before.
Yeah, that's where I was going. And that's one that all of us, I think, everyone listening probably knows Amazing Grace. So go ahead, let's begin with that.
Yeah, Amazing Grace to me, most people know that it was written by John Newton. They probably know that John Newton was a sailor. They probably also know that he was working as a slave trader. Now, if you were a slave trader, you were the absolute worst of the worst. You know, here's this British sailor who couldn't get a job anywhere else but slave boats. And part of your cargo was going to die. You looked at these people as not humans, but literally merchandise to be sold. You were dealing in a world that few people wanted to enter. And the reason Newton was there, that he had been such a violent man and such a drunkard that he could get no work anywhere else. He'd been raised by a loving, God-fearing mother. His father had been a sailor. His mother died young. And Newton, now in his mid-20s, was on a ship coming back from America to Great Britain, his home. And the ship was caught in a storm, a hurricane.
Mm-hmm.
And the sailors were scared to death. They were going to die. And they knew Newton had a knowledge of prayer because his mother had always said prayers over him. So they asked him to pray, and he prayed, and the storm went away, and they were saved, literally saved. Well, everybody assumes that Newton went back, and his whole life was transformed. It wasn't. It took 3 or 4 more years to transform his life. As soon as he got back to shore, he hit the bars and was drinking and carousing and continued to serve as an officer on a slave trader for another couple of years. Finally, he went to the Wesley brothers and talked to them. They were the ones who started the Methodist movement in Great Britain that came to this country. And eventually turned his life around. He became finally a moral man. So his transformation did not come immediately. And I think that's a wonderful lesson for all of us, because we assume that when someone finds God, they're immediately going to be this great moral person. Everything that was destructive in their life is going to walk away. Sometimes it takes a while for that transformation. God works his way in his own time schedule with different people. And it takes time for them to lose their old habits, a lot of times even after they find God. That was the way it was for Newton. Eventually, he became a pastor. And I think it was an Anglican church. It may have been a non-denominational church. But in 1779, in Alderney, England, he stood before his flock, and he read a poem about his story.
Mm-hmm.
And the poem was Amazing Grace. It was set to music. Soon it was being sung in England. It was brought to the United States, where it was sung in various localities, and a man in the United States actually added the verse that we find about heaven in this song. When I've been there 10,000 years, bright shining as the sun, I've no less days to sing God's praise than when I first begun. And eventually that got translated to we, when we've been there, and more of a corporate feel to it. But here's this man who created this new verse with it and then married it. He probably married it. We don't know specifically. Someone did, to an American folk song, either known as Virginia or Kentucky Harmony. And the version we sing of Amazing Grace today is a combination of Newton's experience halfway between the United States and England when he was a slave trader, his conversion, his giving his life to service of the Lord, and then telling his great story in a poem that became a song, and then was brought back to the United States, where a verse about heaven was added that completed the entire Newton journey from sinner to, ultimately speaking, a man who helped start the movement that freed the very slaves that he was a part of trading in during his youth. It's an amazing story of redemption. It's also an amazing story, I think, of the fact it doesn't, when lightning strikes, it doesn't necessarily change your life immediately. For some people, it takes a while for them to fully find God and to fully find God's purpose in their life.
You know.
I guess the lesson is, don't give up on those you love, thinking, well, it's got to happen now. No. Keep praying for them. Keep embracing them. And that transformation may take a while, but it in many cases does happen, and the transformation leads to some pretty great things. Because certainly, started with Wayfaring Stranger. Certainly John Newton, throughout most of his life, was that wayfaring stranger's friend. He noticed them. He reached out to them. He embraced them. And his song has probably led more wayfaring strangers to the knowledge of Christ as a Savior than any sermon ever given.
You note that Amazing Grace may have been composed for a single sermon, but it quickly made its way into song books. And then you write near the conclusion, Amazing Grace was written with a musical roadmap showing how to seek forgiveness and then explaining what that forgiveness can mean to the past, present, and future. Still, it took another man to realize that Newton's hymn lacked one vital element of the Christian story of grace and faith. Would you like to read the verses to this? I know you did one, or would you just like me to read it?
Go ahead and read them. I like to listen to you read the lyrics and the verses. You have such an eloquent rhythm with your voice.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, and now I'm found, was blind, but now I see. 'Twas grace that taught my heart to fear, and grace my fears relieved. How precious did that grace appear the hour I first believed. Through many dangers, toils, and snares I have already come. 'Tis grace hath brought me safe thus far, and grace will lead me home. The Lord has promised good to me. His word my hope secures. He will my shield and portion be as long as life endures. Yea, when this flesh and heart shall fail, and mortal life shall cease, I shall possess within the veil a life of joy and peace. The earth shall soon dissolve like snow, the sun forbear to shine, but God who called me here below will be forever mine. When we've been there 10,000 years, bright shining as the sun, we've no less days to sing God's praise than when we first begun. And so not only do we not give up on those who love us, we never give up on God and His amazing grace, which is always there for us. And all we have to do is open our heart, our mind, and soul to receive it. So powerful a hymn.
It is a powerful hymn. And you know, you never know where inspiration is going to come from. I mean, you know, there's a number of songs in this book that were written by people who at one time or another had been slaves. Gospel Ship is another one, is one, Swing Low, Sweet Chariot.
People know that one too, yes.
Is another one of those songs written by a man who was a slave who moved to the Indian Territory and started working in a school run by a missionary for Native American children, and found the best way to share the stories of the Bible was to write songs. And he wrote Swing Low, Sweet Chariot, and it was based as much as anything else on the Old Testament stories of Ezekiel and others who had seen and met God and, you know, got to ride a little bit, you know. And he took Swing Low, Sweet Chariot and created this children's song, and we should not know it, except a visitor was coming to the school. Mm-hmm. And the visitor heard him sing this song with his guitar. And that visitor took it back to Nashville, Tennessee, and taught it to the Fisk Jubilee Singers and their conductor, a man named Work. And they took it to England, where it got 4 standing ovations in London, and the Queen and King themselves wanted to hear it again and again and again. And it became one of the few Negro spirituals that we can put a name to, and the man's name was Wallace Willis, who wrote that song. And it is such a testament, I think, of the fact of how people see us going from this world to the next. With a Wesley, it was over the, you know, with one of the Wesley brothers was going over Jordan. You know, with the slave, it was taking a ride in a gospel ship. He'd come to America as a slave in a ship. God was going to take him home in a ship. And here, we have a chariot coming down. And you have to realize that, you know, the chariot would have been the fanciest, most powerful vehicle in the world. And God was sending that luxurious vehicle, if you will, the top of the line, to get you. You were that important, and he's going to take you to heaven in style. And for a poor person, I think realizing that God was going to take you up to heaven in style said a great deal about how much God thought of you and loved you. You know, you're on equal plane with everybody else. And I think maybe that's the enduring nature of Swing Low, Sweet Chariot, not just the snappy deed and the great lyrics, but also the fact that, man, what a ride it's going to be when you leave this earth and go to the next one.
Yeah, you write that he lived his faith through his passion for helping the poor and displaced. He believed he needed to spiritually grow to become an even better neighbor, friend, and mentor. And I was among such people. Today, we have a religious community here in Pittsburgh, and it's in other places in the United States called the Little Sisters of the Poor. They rely completely on the charity of others to support their ministry, and they support the poor. They have places where lower housing for people to live, and if you're not poor, you are not accepted, because that's their ministry, and they speak so well about how beautiful their ministry is and how much they receive in turn, far greater than anything that they give to others or do for others. And you close this particular song by saying the fact that God is sending a chariot for all those who have been accepted Christ means that, thanks to grace, a slave gets to ride in a vehicle that on earth was restored for only those of social standing and political power.
And, you know, that's one of the amazing things. You go through these stories, and, you know, we don't have time to mention hardly any of them, much less all of them, but you're left with certain things and certain imagery that when you put them all together, all 30 of them, they build a picture of heaven that is not just a glorious place, but an accepting place, a place where love abounds. We're Marching to Zion is another great song. And the one thing I want to emphasize is, you know, the Catholic Church had wonderful old hymns that they sang, even in, as early as, you know, 1,000 years ago. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them have survived. But the Protestant Church has pretty much ignored that for hundreds of years and just sang the Psalms out of the Book of Psalms. And Isaac Watts was a teenager, you know, and, you know, let's go back 300 years. I mean, Isaac Watts was sitting at a lunch with his father, who was a minister, who had just conducted a service, and the father asked the teenage son, "What'd you think of the service?" And yes. Isaac's response was, "It was boring."
Yes.
Now, would you say that to a child? I mean, you know, you think teenagers don't speak their mind today. They were speaking their mind 300, you know, 400 years ago. And I thought the father's answer was wonderful. Well, why is it boring? And he said, because we sing the same things over and over again. We sing them with 5 or 6 different tunes. Look out there, Dad. Nobody's paying any attention. And the dad issued a challenge. Well, Isaac, if you can do better, then do something. And that night he wrote a hymn, and the man, and here we talk about marching to Zion, but over the course of his life, Isaac Watts would write 500 hymns, and if you will, pave the way for us to have Amazing Grace and others, because his songs were essentially personal looks at relationships with God. And I think that's where heaven comes in these songs. It's about personal relationships, each person's experience, each person's inspiration. And without Watts writing songs like We're Marching to Zion, perhaps, you know, Joy to the World, When I Survey the Wondrous Cross, or you know, Oh God, Our Help in Ages Past, Come We That Love the Lord. You look at all these wonderful songs that he wrote that revolutionized the way all of us sing about God.
Yes.
And it was all because of a father, rather than slapping his son or getting mad at him or grounding him because he said something about the service, challenged him to do something better. And he did. We've all benefited from it. And We're Marching to Zion, which is really a combination of John Wesley and Isaac Watts' work, is one of those classic examples of hymns that we wouldn't have if a father hadn't challenged his son. Do something about it. Make it better.
Right.
And I think that's the challenge for each one of us. You know, how can we take the gospel, if you will, and phrase it in such a way that someone who's not listening suddenly will hear it for the first time? And certainly Watts figured out how to do that.
And so you point out that without realizing it, that little church had set in motion a monumental change in worship. The move, you write, to singing songs not taking directly from the Bible was not without controversy. Many churches split over this new kind of music. Many felt that singing songs penned by commoners was a part of Satan's plan to corrupt young people. But at the same time, people from across the city flocked to hear Watts preach. But most left, you write, with a far better understanding of faith as learned through his original music. And you note also that messages personalized and presented in music really awakens the soul. And that's what your books are really about. And I would point out to people, and it was the Christmas books, of course, first of all, that really influenced me, affected me, that I would say my soul was awakened when I came to realize what I was singing. And how it came into being, and what's the storyline behind it. Exactly. And because then you begin to understand how God was a part of it all in divine providence, and didn't just happen the things in people's lives, as you've noted so far, but it was all part of God's plan to accomplish the things that were accomplished. And
it is a wonderful path that we get to lead if we follow that path in faith. It doesn't mean that we are going to have an easy route, but it does mean that we have someone walking step by step with us along that path. And each one of these songs in this book, I think, really does point that out. From Wayfaring Stranger to Victory in Jesus, we find out that the road we're taking, we're not traveling by ourselves.
And he wondered how anyone but God could love a man such as he. And there are many people around today who feel that very way. And so God doesn't shut them off, but they shut themselves off to God till he finds a way to break through their heart and soul.
Mm-hmm. And in a lot of cases, it's our responsibility to knock on that door for that lonely person and share with them what we already know.
Why don't we go to the last one? We're not going to run out of time, but since you said the bookends, the bookend here is Victory in Jesus. Let's speak about that before the news break.
Victory in Jesus is a song that I often refer to, having grown up in the Baptist church, the Baptist National Anthem, because it's sung in so many Baptist churches across the South in particular. And it is a powerful testimony of a man who was, if you will, one of the fathers of gospel music. Brumley wrote so many great songs. Brumley was his student, but Eugene Bartlett wrote so many great songs about living a positive life. But Brumley himself was one of those positive people who ever walked the face of the earth. This man who traveled all over the world singing his songs and sharing them with people, many of them were gospel songs. He also wrote great country music songs. If you recently saw the PBS special on country music that Ken Burns did, you would have heard a little piece of one of Brumley's songs that was written for little Jimmy Dickens, Take a Old Cold Tater and Wait. He wrote about things that made us smile, and he wrote hymns about things that made us happy and lifted up. Well, everyone saw that Bartlett only had faith because he had never been challenged. Even during the Great Depression, this man had continued to live well because his music was so appreciated and sold so well. And he's coming back from a tour of America. He pulls into a train station in Siloam Springs, Arkansas, and has a stroke. And the man who traveled all over the globe, now in his early 50s, is in a room by himself with his wife tending to him, and he can't even talk. And they're waiting for him to finally be able to shape his hand into a fist and shake it at God for doing this to him. It took him a couple of months to learn how to speak, and then it took him another couple of months to be able to shape that hand into a fist. But he jammed a pencil in it, and the man who used to write a song in 5 to 10 minutes now took hours to write a word. And yet over a couple of months wrote his last song, Victory in Jesus. It was a testament to the fact that his faith was even stronger after he had been challenged, after he had been felled, than it was even when everything was going his way. And I think Victory in Jesus is therefore one of the most powerful songs I've ever heard in my life.
Okay, good. I was going to break in because we have a break to make, but you have done that. And he wrote a song on what he had discovered in the Bible. I've read the back of the book, and we win. Let's take this break. Welcome back to the second hour of Amplify with our special guest, Ace Collins, who we were like 10 or 12 years in a row. Then last year was the first time we didn't get together because the schedules just didn't mix up. So we're so pleased we can be back together again. He's the Christie Award-winning author of more than 80 books that have sold more than 2.5 million copies. Look him up and you can find out some of the things that he's written. And Ace, we had talked about perhaps we might read from your latest book, Stories Behind the Songs in hymns about heaven, or we could go back to some of the Christmas books or tradition stories behind the best love songs of Christmas. I'm just as pleased to stay with this book, but if you want to go anywhere at any time, I'll go with you.
Do that. We probably need to touch on Christmas a little bit to give them a preview of what the season's all about. If there's some other story in heaven that you want to talk about in the heaven book, we can do that as well. That's kind of up to you. You be the shepherd, and I'll be the sheep. How's that?
Well, no, let's work together. Let's both be shepherds. Let's both be shepherds. Let's talk about Glory Train and Ricky Nelson. I find that to be an interesting story.
You know, there was something, you know, we'll give you two songs for one here. We'll give you a Black Friday deal.
Okay, wow.
We'll end up with Glory Train, but Glory Train exists because of another gospel song, and it was a gospel song called Peace in the Valley, and written by Thomas Dorsey, not the band leader, Thomas Dorsey, the gospel music writer. And Dorsey was a Southerner who went to Chicago, got caught up in the blues movement of the 20s, made his life in bars, eventually went back to his faith in God and started writing songs that nobody would publish at first because they just weren't corporate worship songs. They had that echo of that blues effect. And with Precious Lord, Take My Hand and a few others, he created songs that opened up a whole new way of looking at gospel music. Well, he was riding on a train in 1939, right before World War II. Matter of fact, Europe was already fighting World War II. He was reading about it. He looked out the window at this beautiful, perfect scene, and he sat down and he wrote Peace in the Valley, because he wrote the song because there was no peace on earth. There's this African-American man who made his mark in blues and then went to gospel music and changed the way we looked at gospel music. He started the music convention movement that still goes on to this day. Gospel music sings. He really did revolutionize all of that. And in the process of writing this song about peace in the valley, he created a gospel music classic. Well, you know, it was a song that was so important in World War II, because we're in the midst of war and people wanted to believe in peace. And so it really hit its top sales figures, most recorded during World War II, was sung by both black and white audiences, as well as recorded by so many different people. And then kind of disappeared after World War II. And in 1957, on the Ed Sullivan Show, Elvis Presley decided to sing his mother's favorite gospel song. And it was Peace in the Valley, written by Dorsey. And he sang it that night, but before he sang it, he prefaced it by talking about the fact that there were refugees fleeing oppression by the Russians in Eastern Europe, and they were starving to death, and he asked people to send money to the Red Cross. And in 1957, January of 1957, that plea generated millions of dollars in donations, which was unheard of at that time. And it also led to the song Peace in the Valley being so popular that Elvis had to cut it, and by cutting it, he made the song popular all over again. Ironically enough, Dorsey got to watch Elvis sing it on the show, and Dorsey actually outlived Elvis, lived well into his 90s, still performing. So this song was also seen that night by Ricky Nelson. And Ricky Nelson said, well, if Elvis is going to do gospel music, I'm going to do gospel music too, but I want the song written specifically for me. So he went to Baker Knight, who had written a number of Ricky's hits, and including Lonesome Town and others, and he said, Baker, you got to write me a gospel music song. Baker couldn't wait to do it. He actually had grown up in a church singing gospel music, and the church was right by a railroad track. And Baker envisioned what his experiences as a child, as he sat down to write about that train going by the track. And that train was going all these different places, that this little kid who came from a dysfunctional home and who was often mistreated, abused, if you will, who'd escaped some of that abuse by going into the military, ironically enough, riding a train to get to the place where he would serve, and riding a train home, and then going out to L.A. and starving to death for a while until Ricky Nelson discovered him. And he wrote Glory Train about his experiences in church, of listening to the train go by while they sang the song. And in his version, Glory Train was a track that took you from birth to death. And because you were a Christian, there would be people waiting for you at that last stop, mm-hmm. waiting to take you into glory. If you weren't a Christian, then you were not going to be greeted with a love and affection. If you were not going to have a lonely last stop. You were going to be embraced when you got there. Ricky Nelson cut it, and I like to think that it started a whole new form of music that inspired the Ralph Carmichaels and Kurt Kaisers and led to singers like Amy Grant and others coming into Christian music, because it proved to the establishment, the music establishment, that kids were interested in hearing songs about faith. And it led to, I think, creating contemporary Christian music, which still exists to this day. So I think we owe a nod to Baker Knight, not only for giving us this wonderful story of life and a trek to heaven, but also to Ricky Nelson for singing it on that Ozzy and Harriet show, and the millions of sales that came from that, opening the door for people to start writing songs specifically for teenage and young audiences that were gospel music or religious songs. Before that, they were expected to sing the same kind of songs that their grandfather and grandmother were singing. Now there was a genre for them, and I think it was launched right there on the Ozzy and Harriet show.
Right, and you make the connection between Peace in the Valley and the Glory Train. And if we go back to Dorsey, he had double tragedy in his life. His mm-hmm. wife dies one day, and a child dies the next day. And yes. So we know how he's writing, why Peace in the Valley had a very personal feel. You indicate that though it was universal in its message, it also pulled greatly from Dorsey's experiences as a black man living in a world filled with prejudice. To him and millions of others, life was simply not fair. There were few opportunities, and each day was a struggle. And then,
exactly. I think, probably no one in this book exemplifies that more than Charles Tinley, mm-hmm. From right, who gained fame, if you will, and notoriety right there in the state that you're talking from tonight, Pennsylvania, was the son of a slave who ran 10 miles at night to learn how to read. And once he learned how to read, the only person in his little church that could read the Bible was him, because he was the only one who was literate. He went to Philadelphia trying to escape prejudice. Didn't escape prejudice, but had the opportunity to work as a janitor in a church, and taught himself Hebrew and Greek from the library in that church. He would come back several years later to pastor that church of 150 people. And one of his keys to pastoring was to write songs that went with his sermons. His most famous sermon, you can go to the Smithsonian and read it. It is a dynamic piece about a fruit tree, a peach tree. And all Christians should be so heavily laden with fruit in their lives, from reaching out, from touching people, from changing lives, that the branches of their lives, like that fruit tree, dip down to the ground where even the smallest child can reach out and take that fruit. And when his parishioners came to him and said, well, this is the way we're living, but we're still not being blessed for it. When are we going to be accepted as full citizens? When are we going to have the rights to have things that the white folks have? And Tinley answered them with a song called By and By, When the Morning Comes. All the same. So in other words, those answers are going to come in heaven. But that, just because those answers aren't in the now, doesn't mean that you should not live the way God intended for you to live. You shouldn't see everyone as your neighbor, even if they don't see you as their neighbor. it's time for you to be the good Samaritan in your life, and God will reward you in his spirit here, but in his world in heaven. And heaven knows how many people that inspired, but that church of 150 grew to have over 30,000 members, including whites who came to listen to this great black preacher preach. And seminaries across all denominations sent their students to listen to this, the prince of preachers, as they came to have Tinley called. His songs such as Stand By Me and I Shall Overcome, which will become We Shall Overcome, inspired the civil rights movement. And yet this man's focus was on reaching out to the least of these his entire life. And why? Because he had been one of the least of these. He knew what it was all about.
Let me lead you into what the next song is I'd like to talk about. Let me read the lyrics from it. Shall we gather at the river where bright angel feet have trod, with its crystal tide forever flowing by the throne of God? Yes, we'll gather at the river, the beautiful river. Gather with the saints at the river that flows by the throne of God. On the margin of the river, washing up its silver spray, we will talk and worship ever all the happy golden day. Ere we reach the shining river, lay we every burden down. Grace our spirits will deliver and provide a robe and crown. At the smiling at the river, mirror of the Savior's face, saints whom death will never sever lift their songs of saving grace. Soon we'll reach the silver river, soon our pilgrimage will cease, soon our happy hearts will quiver with the melody of peace. This is one of those that I could almost sing. I can't sing maybe a lot of them, except the very popular ones, but this one I've sung somewhere, and I don't know where, but I know it well. So
it is. You know, it was written by Robert Lowry, who had grown up in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, as a matter of fact, and born in 1826, right at the time of the Great Expansion of the United States, and the cry was, follow the river.
Yes.
I mean, you know, we talked earlier about a train taking you to heaven. We talked about ships taking you to heaven. Well, Lowry, you know, people were going to, you know, Illinois and Indiana and the Great West via the Ohio River to the Mississippi. And Lowry grew up on that. He grew up at a time when churches of all types would gather at the river to have ceremonies from time to time. They might be baptisms. They might be graduations. They might just be picnics. But the river was a very important part of that. Also, the Jordan River is mentioned almost 200 times in the Bible. And so, and from a theological standpoint, rivers were essential. The, you know, the children of Israel crossed the Jordan. It became known as, but for many people, was crossing the Jordan meant coming from this life to the next. From the, you know, this was the way you went to heaven. And Lowry wrote a song about a place where love, grace, perfection, and peace reigned. And therefore, shall we gather at the river was inspired, you know, at a time about the Civil War. It was inspired by a lot of death and destruction, but it was also inspired, if you will, by the book of Revelation and the fact that he saw the book of Revelation not as a destructive force, but a positive force, and he saw that the ultimate victory as being positive, and crossing that river was the way to get from this place to the other. And, you know, I wonder how many Hollywood films that song has been used in.
Yes.
Because sure. It is one of the, it's something that almost everyone in this world can sing. It's not Amazing Grace that everybody knows, but it's still, when you hear the title, you know, you start humming, da, 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 da. You know, it's just an uplifting title. It's an uplifting song. And the beat is just one that, you know, you sing it, you kind of smile. And it is ironic that, you know, in Lowry's mind, you're crossing the river, the same river that Jesus was baptized in, to get to see Jesus again.
And he wanted to lead people through the temptations of life, you write, and into an understanding and an appreciation of service to God. In other words, he felt the call to guide people to heaven. While he was growing up, only one-third of Americans attended church on a regular basis. It's probably less than that now.
It probably is. You know, one of the things I was explaining to a class I was teaching not long ago was we grew up, you and I did, at a time when probably somewhere around 55 to 60% of Americans attended church on a regular basis. That is about the same number that attended church on a regular basis during the late 1800s. Then in the early 1900s, it tailed off. We tend to come back to church when we're challenged. They came back to church in Lowry's time because of the Civil War and Dwight Moody and the Great Revival Movement after that. I will see a time when I think church will be important and the new generation will come back as well. But you and I, raised in the aftermath of World War II, church was something that people clung to because their peace and their security had been so challenged by a world that was at war in World War II. And so in the Great Depression, about 30% of the people went to church. After World War II, the numbers jumped over 60% of the people went to church. Mm-hmm. When your security is challenged, you tend to look for God with a lot more intensity than you do when everything's rock along and you're pretty secure.
You write, Follow the River became the cry of thousands of pioneers who longed for both adventure and the promise of a better life. There was a huge expanse of land begging to be developed, and the people were following the Ohio River to the Mississippi and then using other waterways pushing into what had been wilderness. Ohio begins up here in Pittsburgh. We have the three rivers coming together.
Yep.
It's said in ancient lore, maybe we've talked about this before, but in ancient lore, it indicates that where three rivers come together, especially when they are within mountains or hills, that it tends to be a sacred place. And I'd like to be able to think that. So
that's a part of American Indian lore as well.
Yes, right, so, exactly, right. And so that's why this one in particular attracted me. Rivers and bridges are so much a part of Pittsburgh lore.
When the American slaves sang "Roll Jordan, Roll," they sang it as a sign that they were about to try to escape and go up the Freedom Highway to Ohio, and they were going to have to cross the Ohio River. And in their mind, I want to get to heaven when I die to hear old Jordan roll. That Ohio River was represented Jordan, and Ohio on the other side with its freedom represented heaven. So there was a lot of symbolism for American slaves in the song Roll Jordan Roll.
And you write there, because the Bible is not specific when describing heaven, people have their own ideas as to what the hereafter looks like. It's always an interesting question you can pose. What do you think heaven's going to be like? But you continue, one of the more universal themes in both sermons and songs is that people cross a river to get from this life to the next. And so Wesley understood how to employ the imagery of water in order to reinforce his message, especially with regards to being baptized in water meant that you walked out of that experience as a different person. And so he truly believed that almost all of God's children were a slave to something. And that's true today. And the fact that he wrote more than 500 hymns. So let me stop there before we get into the final. It's hard for me to believe we're going into the final segment of our program. When I talk to you, it all goes so fast. But we're talking with Ace Collins. We're talking about his book, Stories Behind the Songs and Hymns About Heaven. And there's something to us, for each and every one of us, to learn from the lyrics, and especially then all that Ace brings to the background. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the final segment of Amplify. We have just about 20 minutes. We end a couple minutes before the the hour. Ace, why don't we go to as you suggested, some of the Christmas songs and hymns. I'll let you select one. I have the books in front of me. I have stories behind the best love songs of Christmas, and they're all still available. More stories behind the best love songs of Christmas. And then there's the book Stories Behind the Great Traditions of Christmas, which is fascinating. And I always, when you explained how why people don't wish you a Merry Christmas, but a Mighty Christmas.
Yeah, I'd say, God rest you, merry gentlemen. It was written in England by a peasant about 600 years ago, and 500 to 600 years ago, and we sing it that way without knowing what it means. I mean, I always thought it was strange that God would want happy people to sleep, but in that span of time, Mary had several meanings, and also rest had several meanings. Rest also meant make or keep, and so if you sing it just God make you merry gentlemen, it makes more sense. But the word Robin Hood and his merry men, Robin Hood was a mighty man. He was great. And merry also meant mighty back then. And my theory is the man who wrote it actually meant for us to sing it, God make you mighty gentlemen, let nothing you dismay. Remember Christ your Savior was born on Christmas Day, because faith brings you strength. And so therefore, that's kind of the way I think about that every time I sing it. You know, 201 years ago, there was a man named Moore who was a priest. And, you know, it's funny how fast life moves, but all of us have been novices at one time or another where we have been doing something for the first time. And I imagine, Father Ron, that the first time that you ever had any part as a priest in a Christmas Eve mass, that must have been overwhelming. Yes. In a way. It must have been kind of frightening to realize that here you are about to talk about the greatest birth of all time and set in motion and planning for this service. And you know, the responsibility itself must have been overwhelming. I know that's how, you know, Joseph Moore felt, 201 years ago in Orbendorf, Austria, as mm-hmm. he planned for a Christmas Eve service. And everything went wrong. He got to the church and the organ didn't work. And his whole service had been planned around Christmas music, very classical, ornate Christmas music that had to have an organ to accompany the choir. They ran over to his best friend's house, Franz Gruber, who was a school teacher, and told him the problem, and Gruber offered to play the guitar, and he said, no, the music won't work with guitar. And then Moore remembered a poem he had written 2 years before, in 1816, while visiting an uncle. Now, the young priest, who thought his first Christmas Eve Mass was going to end in disaster, went back and got that poem, took it back to Gruber, and the two of them wrote music for it, taught it to the choir. And that night, Stille Nacht, Heilige Nacht, Silent Night, Holy Night, which is one of the most hauntingly beautiful poems ever written, if you just read it as a poem. And it so defined what the first Christmas was yes. sung by that little choir in that Austrian church, and literally became the song that saved Christmas. A few weeks later, the man came by to fix the organ, and he asked them what they did for music, and the priest, you know, Father Moore, played the song. And that man jotted down the lyrics and jotted down the music. 30 years later, or thereabouts, Moore is walking down a street in a large German town, and he hears his song being sung by a cathedral choir. He wonders, how is this possible? You know, he didn't sing it anymore. It was only used once in his church when the organ didn't work. And he found out the man who'd fixed the organ had been the Johnny Appleseed of Silent Night. And by the time that Moore realized that, this song was popular in Africa, in Asia, and in America. It had become, in that 30-year period of time, the most popular Christmas carol of all time. And it was just meant to be used one time only.
Right.
I never know how far
our ideas will go when shared. And certainly this song, which is not the best-selling Christmas song of all time. It's not the most played on radio Christmas song of all time. White Christmas is the best-selling Christmas song of all time. Blue Christmas is the most played song right now on radio over the years. But Silent Night is the most sung song. It's the Jesus Loves Me of Christmas carols. And without a man being the Johnny Appleseed and taking it everywhere, we wouldn't know it to this day. And the most wonderful part of that story, I think, is the fact the name of the church in Austria, where Silent Night saves Christmas for a congregation, is St. Nicholas.
Yes.
And, you know, all of those different elements come together in that story behind that one song. And every time I hear Silent Night, I think of that young priest in his early 20s who thought that his whole Christmas Eve mass was going to fall apart, and thought that he had let down his entire community. And then thanks to a friend and talking to a friend and a little help from God, has made Christmas so much special all over the globe for the last 200 years with his little poem about Christ's birth. You know, and it's an amazing story, but it's also a story that should inspire all of us to share our faith and our joys and our blessings with others as well, because we don't know how far those blessings and those words and those thoughts are going to go before they circle the globe and touch somebody else and change their lives like this priest did. Also, he was always a small-town priest. He never made the big time. Mm. And yet, how many priests anywhere in the history of the church can claim to have written something that has touched that many lives? What an amazing story.
Right. It's those who, priests, ministers who seem to be so simple and perhaps don't appear to have many gifts, except they love their people. And in loving their people...
Love the people and love the Lord.
Love the Lord. Yeah, it's loving the Lord that leads them to love the people that way. And it's much like you said, sometimes we think something we say, we think it's only going to be said once and it's not going to have much meaning. But some of the things we say, some of the things we do carry on forever in God's world, because we need to recognize that all that we do together with God, who is present in our life through His Spirit, through His grace. And wow, if we can only get back to understanding that, much like you had said about God Rest You Merry Gentlemen before you started talking about Silent Night, and you write about it today, that if people today fully understood its unique lyrics, most would probably designate God Rest You Merry Gentlemen as one of the most profound and meaningful hymns in the world. And Silent Night can be that way too, but in a different way. Silent Night, Holy Night.
And let's go back, because, you know, I the first part of our broadcast, we talked about a lot of hymns that were born out of the Protestant movement.
Mm-hmm.
But Christmas songs and Christmas traditions were born of the Catholic tradition. And almost all of them had origins with Catholic missionaries, or Catholic priests or monks, those who were serving the Catholic Church. And these old ancient traditions and these old ancient songs that were born in the Catholic churches resonate so strongly to all of us. Christmas is a time machine. When we hear those songs again, when we participate in traditions again, we're reminded of loved ones that have died, and they're there with us. We're suddenly in the kitchen in our minds with our mothers as she's making Christmas dinner or making Christmas cookies for us. We remember specific ornaments. Whenever I see blue lights, I think of my grandmother, because that's all she would ever put on her tree, blue lights for love.
Yes.
You know, it's what she put on her tree. But go back a couple of years after Silent Night, and let's go to France rather than Austria. And there was a man there who was a part of a small Catholic church, and his priest came to him and said, would you write a poem for the Christmas Eve Mass? And this man agreed to do it. He wrote the poem on the way to Paris. He got to Paris, was and loved his poem so much, he went to a friend of his who wrote operatic music, and he asked his friend to write a tune to go with it. The friend tried to get out of it, didn't want to do it. He said, "No, you're the person that God has told me can write this music." And he wrote this beautiful anthem-like music with it. It sounded so French. And it was sung that night in that little Catholic church, and within 10 years had spread all over France. It was being sung in Protestant and Catholic churches across France. And that is when the clergymen and the leaders of the churches, both Protestant and Catholic, found out that the man who wrote the music was Jewish.
Yes.
And they kicked the song out of the church for being too secular because a Jewish guy had written the music. That didn't stop the parishioners from singing it at home, though. And it came to America in the 1840s and early 50s as not a Christmas song, but as an abolitionist song. Because in the third verse, it said, "Chained shall he free, for our slave is his, our brother, and in his name all oppression shall cease." After the Civil War, it became a very important Christmas song in the United States. And then, in the city where you are right now, a man named Fessenden in 1906 did what was thought to be impossible. He invented a radio transmitter that could transmit the human voice wirelessly.
Mm. Yes.
Nobody thought that there would ever be a transmitter, including Marconi, Bell, and others, that would be that powerful. Yet Fessenden did that right there in Pittsburgh. And that night from Pittsburgh in 1906 on Christmas Eve, he picked up his Bible, and the first words ever heard over wireless radio in news stations and on ships at sea up and down the East Coast was the second chapter of Luke, the story of the birth of Christ. And then Fessenden picked up his violin and played O Holy Night.
Right.
And we have been introducing music via radio to listeners worldwide ever since. O Holy Night was the first song ever played on the radio. And it is, I think, one of the greatest hymns about Christmas ever written. It's more than a carol. It's a hymn. And yes, it was written simply to fulfill a request by a priest from one of his parishioners for a poem to be read at the Christmas Mass. And to me, it's not Christmas until I hear O Holy Night. I don't think anything paints a picture of what the birth of Christ was like that song does.
There are certainly these great classics, and we could talk all night about them. What among the later songs do you like? We have things like Mary, Did You Know? You know, it is so beautiful in its own way, and others like that.
I think when you look at Mary, Did You Know? It was written by Mark Lowry, who, if those of you who are listening out there are familiar with the Gaither Quartet, he's one of the members. He's basically a comedian. He's kind of off the wall, and he was working on writing some dialogue to connect a church cantata in Houston, Texas, and got to thinking, what would it have been like to have interviewed Mary if you were a news reporter? You know, after the crucifixion of Christ and you interviewed Mary, what would you have asked her? And so he started coming up with questions, and before he knew it, he had written lyrics and then eventually found one of his friends 2 years later that could write music to it. And it has become probably the best-known carol of the modern age. And by modern age, I mean the last 30 years. It was written and became popular in the 90s. And it looks at Christmas much differently than any other anthem I've ever heard, because we always look at Christmas as an event. And this made it very personal. This was Christ's birth through the eyes of the mother. I think another powerful tune that many people have not heard, but it has been sung by throughout country music by people like Sawyer Brown, Kathy Mattea, Trisha Yearwood, Reba McEntire, and others, is written by Skip Ewing, and it's from Joseph's perspective. And it is a song called "It Wasn't His Child, It Was God's Child."
Mm.
And there are some incredibly moving lyrics. It talks about Christ being a carpenter. You know, he lived with his hands in wood. He died with his hands in wood. there's imagery there that talks about what an incredible man Joseph must have been to accept the responsibility to raise God's child. You know, and we Joseph gets lost in the picture a lot, but what an incredible man he must have been to have accepted the fact that his bride was going to give birth to God's son. And rather than leaving her because it wasn't his son, he stood by her and loved that child as well. So those are two classics that I think, if you go back to the 1950s and early 60s, Do You Hear What I Hear, written by, ironically enough, a Frenchman named Noel and his wife, who was an American named Gloria. You know, that's always, mm-hmm. always smile when I think of that. Or Little Drummer Boy, written in the 1940s and made popular in about 1960. Or some others. I also like Amy Grant's great song that is very, very popular, called Grown Up Christmas List of the Modern Songs, because I think it touches upon what we all should wish for at Christmas, and our wishes change when we get to be adults, and that we do want a world filled with peace and understanding and love and grace.
I tend to... I have a great devotion to the angels, and so mm-hmm. Hark the Herald Angels Sing is one of my favorites. And then you, you've viewed angels from the realms of glory, and angels we have heard on high. So there are many hymns about angels. Oh, if it's not about them, they enter into it somehow.
Oh, yeah, and Wesley would probably be a little upset that we're singing Hark the Herald Angels Sing, because he wrote it the way it would have been read biblically in Old England. And that's how the Velkin, hark how the Velkin ring. And so, you know, and what is Velkin? It's a word that we've lost now, but Velkin means heavenly host. And when Christ was born, how the heavens rang. You know, that's what he was trying to say. So I think the original concept that he was portraying was even more powerful than Hark the Herald Angels Sing. Hark how the Velkin, all of heaven, rings with the birth of God's Son. And that's a pretty powerful statement to make, and yet Velkin is just a word that we have forgotten now. And I actually looked it up again in church this morning while I was between church, before I was waiting for the service to begin, because I thought about that song, and I thought Velkin, you know, specific meaning of Velkin in the Old Testament, in Old English, and found it once again, and smiled as I was reminded of how the Velkin rang, how the heavens rang when Christ was born. That's a pretty powerful statement when we sing that song.
We've time for one more. Why don't you select the last one?
I think when you look at songs that come about that aren't meant to be Christmas songs, that are Christmas songs, we'll leave on one that will make you smile. In 1840, in Medford, Massachusetts, a young man was assigned by his father to write a song for a children's choir to be sung at Thanksgiving. He couldn't think of anything. He went outside where he was writing and watched these young men actually drag racing sleds that were pulled by horses, these teenagers, and they were trying to impress girls. He went back in and wrote a song called Jingle Bells. It was so popular that Thanksgiving in Medford, Massachusetts, that it was the children's choir was asked to sing it again at Christmas. Well, there were visitors from New York and Boston that were in town, and they thought it was a Christmas song. They didn't realize it hadn't been written for Christmas. And they took it back, and within a decade, it was one of those popular secular Christmas songs in America. I find it amusing now that a song that was written for Thanksgiving has set in motion jingle bells, horse-drawn sleighs, yes. Picturesque of snows. It is what inspired Kurger and Ives to do all the work and things like this. It has created the classic American Christmas. From Holiday Inn, you see the sleds, to White Christmas, the movies. Everything we see on the Hallmark movie, you have these horse-drawn sleds. And without Jingle Bell, that probably wouldn't be the case. And yet what Jingle Bells actually is the world's best-known Thanksgiving song. So yeah, that's right. The magic of of God being able to transform these images into other things that mean something special to us. And so Jingle Bells is my pick of the night as far as when you sing it, think about this. You're actually singing a song written for Thanksgiving.
Yes. Our guest this evening has been Ace Collins. The latest book is titled Stories Behind the Songs and Hymns About Heaven. Ace, thank you for being with us once again. I love when you're able to make it. Blessings on you, your family, and all of your loved ones in the coming great sacred moments we will be celebrating.
And what a joy it is always is to be with you, my friend. I look forward to sitting down as we talk about heaven in the future when you and I are both on the other side of Jordan and sharing stories where we don't have to worry about a time limit cutting us off.
I will certainly enjoy it myself. Thanks. Thanks once again, Ace. Appreciate it. There are so many things that one could say about Ace being here, and I've loved having him over the years. Let me read us out to our close with these lyrics. O holy night, the stars are brightly shining. It is the night of the dear Savior's birth. Long lay the world in sin and error pining, till he appeared and the soul felt its worth. A thrill of hope, the weary soul rejoices, for yonder breaks a new and glorious morn. Fall on your knees, O hear the angel voices, O night divine, O night when Christ was born. O night, O holy night, O night divine. Led by the light of faith serenely beaming, with glowing hearts by his cradle we stand. So led by light of a star sweetly gleaming, here came the wise men from Orient land. The King of Kings thus lay in lowly manger, in all our trials born to be our friend. Truly, he taught us to love one another. His law is love, and his gospel peace. Chains he shall break, for the slave is our brother, and in his name all oppression shall cease. Sweet hymns of joy and grateful chorus raise we. Let all within us praise his holy name. Don't forget then how precious life is and how powerful love is. Tell someone now that you love him or her. Pray for peace as if it depended on you alone. And come back next Sunday and amplify with us.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $150 into something bigger when you bet on moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$150 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
This is Free Range with Von Miller, the podcast where I step outside the lines and I take you with me. Each week, we're talking everything from the biggest stories around the league to the biggest stories off the field. This isn't your average sports podcast. This is game meets culture, locker room meets living room, and no topic is off limits. So if you're into good conversations that ruffle a few feathers, join me every Wednesday and follow Free Range with Von Miller everywhere you get your podcasts.